Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's pretty safe to say that the internet is here to stay. But like all young, world-changing technologies, the jury is still out on whether the power and the promise of the internet will play out in any foreseeable way. The digital world often divides people into two camps. Those who see the internet as a democratic utopia, where traditional capitalist power structures get flattened, and others who see it as an anti-social medium where marketers and intelligence agencies collect our personal data for nefarious purposes. Astra Taylor has a more nuanced view. The documentary filmmaker behind Zizek and Examined Life has a new book out. It's called The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Astra, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Cool. Thank you for having me.
Well, you've said that one of the reasons you wanted to write this book came out of wanting to examine the language of Silicon Valley, how people talk about the internet in those early days before Google and Facebook. And how has that panned out, in your opinion?
Well, so much of the language we use to describe not just what the internet is, but what we want it to be, is imported from Silicon Valley. So we talk about openness, transparency, participation, and these are really powerful words and they're appealing, but they can mean different things depending on who's speaking. So Mark Zuckerberg can say he wants to make the world more open and connected, but that means us as the users of his social media service revealing all the details of our personal lives and all of our connections to other human beings so that he can better help advertisers track and monitor and sell things to us. So open. The more open we are, in a way, the more vulnerable we are, and the more that we're giving a kind of power away to these platforms that, well, they were the underdogs and they were these sort of upstarts not that long ago, less than a decade ago. They're now the most powerful corporations in the world, and increasingly they're moving to monitor us, not just at the keyboard, on our computers or on our cell phones, but in everyday, you know, quote unquote, real life.
Well, some of the things that we do choose is creative work, music, writing, YouTube tutorials, things we think of as free, but which you call a form of corporate subsidy. What do you mean by that?
You know, we see this problem in the broader economy. It's not something that's just unique to the internet, where there's growing inequality. And where corporate profits are at an all-time high and less returns are going to workers and to middle-class Americans. And these technologies are another avenue for that, where we all engage, we are all contributing value, and yet the value is being extracted and going to a small handful of people. I mean, it's amazing that these companies, they're some of the biggest in the world in terms of their market capitalization. Google and Apple are up there vying for the top position, but they have remarkably few employees. They're not like the old companies of yore where, you know, a company was incredibly valuable and employed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people and gave them livelihoods. These companies employ very few people. I mean, WhatsApp was bought for $19 billion, and I think it had about 100 employees or something. So there's structurally something very interesting going on that has big implications.
So do you use those free services? Do you use Gmail? Do you use other services that you don't have to pay for, but you are, as you're suggesting, somehow paying for?
Right. So those free services should always have free in quotes because we always pay with our privacy because the business model of the internet is surveillance if you're not paying with money out of your own pocket. So a mix because these services are so essential to modern life that it's hard to get off them. And I wouldn't want to because, you know, I see all of their utility and the pleasures, too. So, you know, I use Twitter. I'm on Twitter. I'm not an avid Facebook user. I have started paying for my email provider. I don't use Gmail anymore. I use a company called Fastmail. And it just felt to me that it was worth paying what is really a trivial amount in order to have a service that doesn't scan the contents of my emails and try to serve me advertisements. So it's a mix. But one thing I think is important as an independent filmmaker who's trying to get the word out about her films and stuff is I part of the reason I don't invest a huge amount of time into investing into Facebook and building an audience and getting, you know, as many friends as possible is because they can change their terms of service. They can rejig their algorithms. And ultimately, all of that work that I did, all of that investment could be for naught. And again, we're seeing that as people are complaining that they're reaching a smaller and smaller percentage of their community and being asked to pay to reach the rest of them. So, you know, you can put an enormous amount of time and energy into these platforms, and they're not beholden to you. Ultimately, they can change at any moment.
We're speaking with the documentary filmmaker and now author, Astra Taylor. She says the internet has not lived up to its promise of being a liberating democratic force, and that the disruptive impact of the web has been uneven at best, in her words. Her new book is called The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Now, here's a pretty unusual concept that you write about, nationalizing Facebook. Now, what purpose would that serve, and how would a nationalized Facebook look differently from the one we use now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I actually say that we should nationalize Facebook. I say that, you know, there's a resistance to the idea of truly public or socialized services, but that it's ironic because we talk about these sites and services as though they already were public. So obviously online we say things are social. But that means that they're open to people that we can share things. It, of course, doesn't mean that they're socialized or whatever. But there's a sense that we actually want these services, or we want something online that resembles a public park and not just a shopping mall. And that's what I'm actually highlighting. The idea of nationalizing the internet doesn't make any sense. Even if it does make sense to talk about treating the companies that provide us access to the internet as public utilities. And what does that mean? That means that just as phone companies, old landlines, had certain common carrier obligations that they had to take and receive calls equally, and that it was recognized that they were crucial for social life, I believe ISPs should be thought of in the same way. So it's not actually such a radical thought. It gets a little more radical when you go from the level of infrastructure to the level of services that we're using, like Facebook, and you say, okay, we want some sort of public space. We speak of Twitter as a town square, or Facebook as a town square, as places of protest, right? But actually, they're commercial spaces, and they're not really beholden to the civic values. So, you know, what could we do to create more parks on the internet, so it's not just a world of shopping malls?
You talk about needing to carve out a new form of digital public media. Now, aren't crowdfunding platforms like Kickstarter, or despite all its flaws, websites like Wikipedia already a form of digital public media? What are you looking for?
Yeah. Wikipedia is an example that is most commonly invoked. It's probably the most popular example. And it's often held up as kind of almost the platonic ideal of what the internet could be. But we have to recognize that it's very unique. It's actually the only nonprofit, non-commercial site that is in the top 100 sites of, like, most popular sites on the internet. So
wow.
We love it. We talk about it. We invoke it all the time. But actually, it's really rare. So I think a worthwhile question is why there aren't more sites like that, you know, if we think that it brings so much value. And part of the problem for any non-commercial site is funding. And so I think it's absolutely true that crowdfunding services like Kickstarter and Indiegogo and all these things can be really useful. And in fact, I've been part of campaigns that have raised money on those sites. But I think we actually do need something that is a collective funding mechanism for important social goods like journalism.
So what does that look like?
It could look like funding structures that exist in to fund NPR or to fund the CBC or to fund the BBC. I mean, there were moments where in our past where people got so sick of the commercialism on TV and the fact that the lines between advertising and editorial were so blurred. So back in the days around the time of the quiz show scandal and you know, the days when soap operas sold soap, that people organized and started trying to insert a sort of firewall between those two. And then that gave rise to a push for slowly over time for public media, for explicitly non-commercial spaces. And so a lot of those principles still apply in this day and age. I think it's about creating media in a time of scarcity. So it's not forcing people to look at public media over anything else, but making sure there is more public media in the mix. And there are plenty of strategies for funding this kind of content that limit the government's influence and all of these concerns people have.
Well, I think of sites like ProPublica or the Center for Public Integrity, for example, that are doing investigative journalism, among others. But I also think about that idea of having public funding devoted that way. You know, that's something that we come up against in public media when political tides change, you know, wanting to take
right.
the money away.
Yeah, and that's a risk. But it's also risky to depend on the patronage of wealthy people and billionaires, mm-hmm. so because they can be fickle too. And, you know, people often worry that investing in public media would actually be less democratic because it would be state-sponsored, and that raises some alarms. But you know, plenty of groups have shown that actually the countries with the highest investment in public media are generally the most democratic. And I'm talking about the magazine, for example, The Economist, which is hardly some crazy left-wing magazine, has a democracy index. And the countries that rank at the top of that list that they believe are the most democratic, have the most economic freedom, tend to have really generous state subsidies for news. I mean, often, you know, we spend about $1.50 a person. Some of these countries, like Norway, spend over $100 per citizen. And that's because then the paradox is that the more robust the investment in public media, the more the public media can push back on the government, on corporate interests, and actually do the job of independent journalism. And for some reason, we like to ignore those other examples.
Well, we definitely don't have the majority view. I mean, we know that people, in fact, even talking about developing public media is a little bit like saying you better eat your broccoli, even though we're at a buffet full of, you know, cupcakes and desserts. You know, people pick up the cupcakes and desserts on the internet, right?
Yeah, but, you know, not always. I think the thing is that you have to have both options visible to even choose the broccoli. And there's a way in which the current model, the sort of commercial and advertising driven news sites, get into a sort of feedback loop where they're just offering the candy, they're just offering the quick clicks because that's what they need to stay afloat. And you know, I've talked to some journalists, and actually it's in the book, where they say, actually, you know, when you go deeper and you offer something different and offer something that has a longer lifespan, it's not just of the moment, you know, whatever's trending in the search engine or whatever celebrity has tripped on the red carpet or whatever, people will look at it. It might take more time. The value might not be immediately apparent. But I think if you trust the intelligence of your listeners and your viewers, people will make more diverse choices.
Astra, you write about the problem of online power structures requiring collective political action. But short of dedicating our lives to the cause, what are some of the consumer or user choices that people can make differently that might put the internet back in the hands of the people, as your book hopes for?
I think the most urgent thing for people to get involved in is the struggle for net neutrality, because there are worrying signs from the FCC that they're going to do an about-face on that and essentially transform what has been a fundamental characteristic of the net and one of its most democratic traits, which is that all data is treated equally. So a large site like Amazon.com can load as fast as my personal website. And they're looking into allowing fast lanes that are paid for by companies that have deep enough pockets to do that. So that's a struggle that's really easy to join. There are many nonprofits and activist groups that are doing everything from online petitions to organizing protests. This is an issue that is really coming to a head around the globe. There are massive street protests around a bill that would also eliminate net neutrality in Mexico, and people are forming a human chain and really fighting back. So that's something that doesn't need to take up your entire life, but could have huge implications for our society down the road.
Astra Taylor, documentary filmmaker behind Zizek and The Examined Life. Her new book is called The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Astra, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Now, you'll find more on her book online at wordofmouthradio.org.